Thank you very much for the introduction. Today I would like to tell you what type of interactions one can induce using polar molecules, and essentially I would like to focus on that, but there is a possibility to really make strong three-body interactions using polar molecules. So atomic and molecular gases have gone a long way, as is probably now well known here, and is well demonstrated in this workshop, that while first starting with weakly interacting systems which have been very dilute, it soon has become aware that actually a high tunability in the systems allows to induce interactions and drive the systems into strong correlations. And a few examples which are well known now is that if you rotate the condensates, you can induce vortices. And as the search for fractional quantum Hall states, if you induce high enough rotations in a system, we can tune the interaction in the systems via Feshbach resonances, and we can drive molecules into the systems. This can be either Feshbach molecules, which means that they are weakly bound molecules, which are very large, or if one is able to manage to put these molecules actually in a ground state, that this can give rise to polar molecules, which will be the focus of my talk today. And as you have certainly also heard in this workshop, there's the BCS-BC crossover, which one can drive using a Feshbach resonance. And the other main tool for driving the interactions in the system is actually by quenching the kinetic energy of the systems, introducing an optical lattice, which then reduces the ratio, or allows to tune the ratio between the hopping energy and the interaction energy, and also allows to derive Hubbard models which can exhibit strong correlations, and for example also exotic phases even drives a ring exchange interaction. Now in my talk I would mainly focus on polar molecules. I will show you how one can derive the interactions in the system, and in the end we'll derive your Hamiltonians which one can achieve with polar molecules using optical lattices. So in my first talk, I will give you a little bit of introduction into polar molecules. We'll show you how one can drive long-range interactions, what one has to do to actually stabilize the system, and once one has stabilized the system, that it is possible to drive a superfluid to crystalline phase transitions, which means that actually the interaction energy is so large that even in a 2D plane, it exceeds the kinetic energy, and this ground state is no longer determined by a superfluid, but actually by a crystalline phase. And then I want to show you that using now an additional tool, namely additional shining in a microwave field, it allows to tune the interactions further. And essentially, I would like to show you that it is possible to derive strong three-body interactions in a system. So why are polar molecules so interesting? It's just okay. I mean, there are many ideas to look for strongly correlated phases if called atoms, and I completely agree. We don't know actually all the physics if we just have two-body interactions. But if one wants to look for topological phases, then one knows that in many of these examples, free-body and higher interactions are relevant if one wants to make, for example, a loop gas, which is then interacting. And in that respect, this gives you an additional tool, actually, to a novel way to introduce interactions, which then can give rise to exotic phases. Whether it will give rise is not known. So I will just present you in this talk that actually it is possible to induce such interactions. Now, why are polar molecules interesting? The main reason is that the many tools which we have, which are well established and called gases, can be taken over to polar molecules. For example, there are electronic excitations which allows to trap the molecules into magnetic and in optical traps. There are internal spin states which allows to use magnetic fields to address different states. But in addition, they also have a permanent dipole moment in a rotational ground state, which allows to induce strong dipole-dipole interaction, which in 3D is even long range and decays with 1 to the r to the cube. And however, one has to be careful because these dipole interactions can be so strong that actually the system has a tendency to become unstable. And in my talk, I would like to show you that if we confine the system into 2D, it's possible to avoid these instabilities and actually enter the regime where we have very strong dipole-dipole interactions in a stable context. And this then will give rise to the quantum melting transition from superfluid to a crystalline phase. Now, unfortunately, polar molecules are not yet available in the lab, but there are different groups which are trying to cool polar molecules to quantum degeneracy. And there are essentially two approaches which have to be distinguished. So there is one method which starts again and essentially redoes all the tools which one has done for cooling atoms, and starts with a hot molecular gas and then starts cooling the molecular gas to low temperatures. The very bad message in these methods is that that laser cooling is very inefficient, as it just starts to heat the internal degrees of freedom of the polar molecule. So laser cooling, except for some few molecules, is highly inefficient for these gases, and one has to apply different methods for actually cooling them. Tools are, for example, buffer gas cooling, that one uses a cold helium gas as a buffer gas which cools the polar molecules. Then one traps the polar molecules and cools them further with evaporative cooling. In this way, it was possible to actually cool polar molecules in a rotation, in a lowest rotational ground state, so such that higher rotation of the polar molecule has been frozen out. The other method, which is also very appealing, is that actually one doesn't start with a hot gas, but one rather tries to combine the molecules and using for that cold atoms. So one takes a heteronuclear gas of atoms, so two species gas of atoms, cools them to quantum degeneracy, and then tries to form polar molecules in a coherent way without heating the sample. And this is essentially via photo association. So we have here, as a sketch, one sees here the two atoms which will constitute the polar molecules. And then one tries via a Raman laser or by spontaneous emission, combine these two atoms into the lowest rotational and vibrational ground state. The problem with this method is that the overlap between these two wave functions is rather small, and so special tools have to be applied that actually this can be achieved with high efficiency. So there are many groups applying this method, and the most promising approach is currently using an optical lattice, having then always two different species in one lattice site, using a Feshbach resonance to make a large bound state, and then use photo association to combine this Feshbach molecule into a rotational ground state. The disadvantage of this method is that only a few polar molecules are achievable, namely the one for which the atoms have already been cooled. So these are mainly rubidium cesium, lithium cesium, so the alkali atoms, and maybe earth alkali, while the first approach really would allow to cool arbitrary molecules like strontium oxide, or even more complex molecules like ammonium or whatever one wants.
Can you say what happens to that energy?
It is taken out by the laser. So
it doesn't need it.
Exactly, yeah. So the aim is to make this process coherent and take the energy. So via Raman transition, it absorbs one photon and emits another photon, and the energy difference between these two photons is exactly the energy necessary to go in the ground state.
What happens to the recoil momentum?
That will heat the sample, so recoil will be a problem, but recoil is still at quite a low temperature, and then with evaporative cooling.
Recoil, first of all, can essentially almost be taken out in a Raman configuration.
That's also true.
Also that you what is part of an optic lattice. Mm-hmm. It's taken up by the lattice.
Yeah, that's. Okay, so then one has to focus, well, what are the lowest energy excitations of a polar molecule? And as said, a polar molecule is made by two different atomic species, so there is an axis, a molecular axis in the system, which is parallel to a polar, to a dipole moment, and the low energy excitations are rotations of these polar molecules. So the low energy description is well given by a rotor describing the rotation degree of freedom of the polar molecule. And the typical splitting of the rotor levels is of the order of 10 gigahertz, which means that one can first, because there is a dipole, one can address these dipoles via electron and magnetic fields. That frequency difference is in a microwave range, so we can address the drive transition between the ground state and the first excited states using microwave fields. There is no spontaneous emission anymore because the microwave frequency is so low, so one can neglect spontaneous emission. And furthermore, the spectrum is anharmonic, so if we derive a transition between the ground state and the first excited state, we will not have accidental excitations of higher states. And this is a nice tool to actually now play with these different ground states. Now, in reality, the structure of the polar molecules are much more complicated. So there are not only the rotational degree of freedom, there are also the vibrational degree of freedom and the electronic degree of freedom. So these are the different potential curves for two atoms. Here it is oxide and strontium approaching each other. So the polar molecule in a rotational and vibrational ground state is trapped down here at the typical interparticle distance of 2 angstroms. Then we have another electronic excitations, which we can use for making optical traps. So by shining in, again, lasers, we can now trap and create optical lattices by driving a far detuned transition from the red curve to the blue curve. So in this sense, we can make all the tools available for atoms, also for the polar molecules. However, if we zoom in here, we see that there are all the excitations like vibrations and rotations. But happily, all these energy scales are well separated. So vibration have a typical energy splitting of 20 terahertz, while the rotational degree of freedom are of typical 10 gigahertz. So one can individually address the different excitations, and in our approach, the vibrations can essentially completely neglect it. So vibrations is rather a nuisance at the moment and are not very useful for tuning interactions, but happily they are also mainly irrelevant. And so our characteristic energy scale is the rotational degree of freedom, which is of the order of 10 gigahertz. And in addition now, if one has here, I have chosen strontium oxide because this is a very easy molecule because it doesn't have nuclear spin and no electronic spin, so it has a closed shell at lower structure. But if one chooses different polar molecules, one can also have an electron which is then interacting with the rotation of the polar molecules, and can also have nuclear spin, which then gives rise to hyperfine splitting. So one can repeat everything which is essentially known about atoms. And so the low energy Hamiltonian for two polar molecules reduces to this form. So we have the kinetic energy of the polar molecules. We have the trapping potential, which we assume to be optical, which can give rise to optical lattices. They have the internal excitations, which are described by a rigid rotor. And we have the electric field, which allows to drive transition within the rigid rotor. And then we have the strong dipole-dipole interactions of the polar molecule. Now, if the polar molecule is in the lowest rotor state, it has no net dipole moment. Because the lowest rotor state, the polar molecules rotates around all axes, so the average dipole moment is zero, and it doesn't have a dipole-dipole interaction. So in the ground state, the interaction is determined by the van der Waals attraction again, which is that one virtually excites polar molecules from the ground state into the first excited state and back, which gives rise to a usual attractive 1 to the R6 van der Waals attraction. Yes?
That
there was an electronic angular momentum for this
molecule, just when you were back on the lab transparency.
No, here, we don't have angular momentum.
Sorry,
I guess
O2
that was
electronic
angular momentum. Yeah, I will have to look. This is okay. Sigma ground state, yeah. Okay. So, but if one would, for example, use strontium fluoride, then one has an additional electron with a spin which will couple to the rotation of the polar molecule. Okay, so in ground state, all these rotational states are non-interacting except van der Waals, which is of the same order as for atoms. However, as soon as one applies a static electric field, the ground state becomes polarized and gives rise to a finite dipole-dipole interaction. Now the polarization can be calculated from the rotor spectrum, how it behaves if you apply an electric field, and it's clear that the dipole moment induced in the ground state has to be smaller than the maximally dipole moment, which means it would be if the polar molecule is maximally stretched. And so the interaction is given by the usual dipole-dipole interactions, which is if we apply the electric field along the z-axis, it behaves like 1 to the r cubed minus the typical anisotropic factor, which tells us that two polar molecules in the plane with polarization along z-axis repel each other, but if they are on top of each other, they have a strong attraction. And if one has weak dipole-dipole interaction, this attraction is not so important, and the change for the scattering of two polar molecules is essentially very weak. So for weak dipole-dipole, we still have good S-wave scattering and the weak corrections due to the dipole-dipole interaction. If one starts to increase the dipole-dipole interaction, there are many instabilities appearing in the system. One is, if one is in a three-dimensional sample, that the attraction renders the system essentially attractive, and the same happens as if one has attractive bosons. The systems start to compress. As soon as many particles are on close together, free body recombination sets in, which heats the sample, and the sample will explode. So there are several instabilities if one tries to increase the free body interaction. However, this has been well studied. For the collapse has been studied in the system. It is known how strong the dipole moment is allowed to be compared to the S-wave scattering length before this instability set in, and has also been discussed that actually instabilities are associated with a rotor softening, and there is the question whether actually close to this instability the appearance of supersolids is possible. Now in my talk,
it's not really a rotor, it's long range.
It looks like a rotor. So if you look at the Bogolyubov excitation spectrum, it really looks like a kink. So the spectrum will exhibit a minima.
Right, but its scale has nothing to do with the densities. I mean, it's really just a image of neutrons.
Yes, it. Let me think for that actually appears.
Yeah, in that
sense, not. So here mainly the name appeared due to the close equivalence of the excitation curve to helium, and not really because it has something.
I mean, it's not any kind of a signature crystallization.
That's the discussion. Whether that is not known actually. Whether, I mean, it's known that the rotor can hit zero. And then the question is what actually appears to the system, whether this will give rise to a supersolid or whether this will give rise to instabilities that the system completely collapses. So there are a lot of discussion what actually happens if the rotor goes to zero.
Yeah, But that's broken. Then what mode? Do we have in density or in orientation or?
This is so this is density structure factor, if you want. So a it couples to density, and it's the appearance of a density mode in a system. So this would indicate a solid transition. The question is just whether it's really stable once this.
But do you know what the scale is?
I will have to look it up. It depends on the S-wave scattering length. It's competition between S-wave scattering length and the dipole-dipole interaction. I will have to look it up exactly what
that was. I just came to the transition, but you might know this. So what's the rotational energy splitting? What is that in temperature?
Rotational energy splitting is 10 gigahertz. In temperature, that's okay. 100 millikelvin. Yeah, it's about 100 millikelvin.
Right.
Which is completely high compared to this quantum degenerate gases, which should be of the order of microkelvin.
But it's no problem turning on electric fields. And
the electric fields are really in this range, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you stabilize the stability of some fermionic dipoles?
It probably, it's not really known, it probably will stabilize it a little bit. But also for fermions, we have free body recombination. And so it will maybe enhance a little bit the lifetime, but it will not really stabilize the system. So what we want to do here is we really want to go into the strongly interacting limit and actually stabilize the system by applying a tight transverse confining. So this, along the z-axis, we have the electric field, so the polar molecules are polarized along the z-axis. Now we apply a tight trap along the z-axis, which should now stabilize the system. Now let me show how this exactly appears. So as soon as we have a trap, we can essentially represent the interaction between polar molecules as a dipole-dipole interactions. But now we have to pay the trapping potential if the relative coordinate between the polar molecules increases. So we have like an effective interaction, which has a large set squared dependence in that direction. Now I can plot this potential, which is here, which is a density plot. So here's the set directions. This is the distance between the polar molecules. So along this line, we have the nice 1 to the r cubed repulsion. These areas are the region where the polar molecules are strongly attractive. Now we see that due to the trapping potential, there is a potential barrier which separates the regime where the polar molecules are repulsive from the area where they become attractive. And now by making this barrier actually so high that it is larger than the temperature of the gas, the particles have to tunnel through this barrier to actually enter this instability region. And estimating this tunneling amplitude shows that for strong dipole interactions, allows to stabilize the system. So, using that, we have a dimension, we can write it in a dimensionless with a characteristic length scale, L perop, which is the position of this barrier. So, we assume we have to go into the regime where L perop is much smaller than the interparticle distance. Then we can calculate the tunneling barrier and the tunneling probability for this barrier, which within WKB takes the form that we have a prefactor times the exponent of the classical action for the barrier. And this classical action scales for with the transverse trapping confinement and a dipole interaction. Yes?
I'm going to say about the coordinate here. I mean, the potential, it's the separation of two particles, whereas in the interaction, it's the separation of two particles, whereas in this potential, it's the.
Yes, but a quadratic potential also separates in relative and absolute coordinates. So this is the part in relative. In addition, there will be just the collective, the center of mass motion of the polar molecules, which is also a harmonic trapping potential. But if they want only in relative, it gives also part to a set squared. So this is only the relative part of the trapping potential. Then there's an additional center of mass part for the trapping potential. And this is nice because a quadratic potential.
They both want to sit in a, you know, if you have two molecules like this and then the dipoles are aligned.
Yes.
You want to be, they're attracted.
Yes.
But now they're also, the external potential, the Z potential, the trapping potential is also wants to have them sit at Z equals zero. I don't know.
Yes. So the potential here is, that's exactly the position here. So here they are strongly attractive.
Right, that, from the dipole interaction.
From the dipole and the transverse trapping potential. And we don't want the particles to be here because then we have instability due to free body recombinations. So we want to trap the system metastable, that we prepare them that they all are at the beginning far apart. So we prepare the system that at the beginning we are in this region,
is
the interparticle distance. And then we look what is the rate that they actually can get into this attractive part. And if this rate is smaller than the lifetime of than the characteristic timescale for the experiment, I don't have to worry that ever two polar molecules will be into this position. So we prepare them being in a plane, being a little bit far apart, let the system evolve, and calculate what is the probability that they actually tunnel through the barrier.
For them to be like this, they have to be further separated.
To be on top of each other, they have to tunnel through this, they have to cross this barrier. And if this barrier is high, they have to tunnel through this barrier. But because the barrier is really a large barrier, they have to tunnel semi-classically, and the rate can be estimated via WKB. And actually for typical parameters, this exponent can be of the order of 100. So E minus 100 gives an incredibly small tunneling rate, which means that the system is really stabilized, and during the experiment there will be never a tunneling of the polar molecules through this barrier. But it's a metastable state, I completely agree. The ground state would be that all polar molecules will be attracted here, and then free water recombination sets in, and the system flies apart.
The other point is also that if the particles are actually tunneling through, there could be kind of resonance there. It doesn't mean that this is necessarily completely destructive once they come. There could also be kind of shape resonance there, you know, the sort of bound state there.
Can, yes.
I remember in the early days people discussed how you get the stability of condensates, and I think if people calculated sort of single particle lifetimes and also lifetime due to collective effects, but is there, was it ever resolved, which is the, you know, because in principle you could imagine instead of just a single particle trajectory, a collective collapse, and is it clear which?
I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, in the end, you have.
Well, I mean, you're telling me that you just formed one particle, but you had a collective corner, which was the appearance of a larger scale of density.
I don't see how this would actually decrease the tunneling action.
Well, I just remember there was some discussion in the prehistory by it.
Okay, I don't think that would be here relevant because the energy scales are pretty well that we are far away from this barrier, and so you need to have many particles close to each other, which actually costs already high energies. So which will just lead to increase of your tunneling action. So, but using these tools, we now know that we can integrate out the particles are confined into 2D, we can integrate out the fast transverse motion, they are essentially confined in the lowest harmonic oscillator in transverse direction, integrate over the dipole-dipole interactions, and obtain an effective 2D potential. And now it's possible to combine everything and write down the effective Hamiltonian. So we have again the kinetic energy of the polar molecules, and now I really have derived you that it is possible in a 2D plane to have strong dipole-dipole interaction. between the polar molecules. And we studied this Hamiltonian using quantum Monte Carlo simulations. Now, just for parameters, if one uses strontium oxide, there's a dipole moment d of order of 9 d by, then we have an important parameter, which is the dimensionless parameter determined by the characteristic interaction energy divided by the kinetic energy, which takes the form that it is the dipole moment squared times the mass divided by h bar squared divided by the characteristic interparticle distance. And this parameter Rs, written for strontium oxide, is of the order of 121 micrometers divided by the interparticle distance. So if we assume that the interparticle distance is of order of 300 nanometers, you see that Rs can become of the order of 400, and can be arbitrarily tuned between 400 and lower values. And if you assume a transverse trapping potential achieved by an optical lattice, which is reasonable 40 nanometers, we see that the action actually is larger than 130. And so tunneling through this barrier is completely suppressed.
Can I ask a question? Okay, this Hamiltonian for the 2D system is, if the power was 1 instead of 3, would be exactly the Wigner-Christol Hamiltonian.
Yes.
And say, describing electron plus Coulomb.
Yes.
So there it has been analyzed by doing elastic expansion around the perfect continuation. Does the fact that the power here is different changes essentially the phase? Okay, maybe we'll discuss it in a moment.
Yes. No, usually I drop. So I wouldn't call the crystal here Wigner crystal because 1 over r cubed in 2D is not long range. It is integrable, and therefore, in contrast to Wigner crystal, I can cut off this interaction at some distance, and I still get the crystalline phase. In contrast to a Wigner crystal, that if I cut it off at some distance, it's a long range part which stabilizes the crystal for Wigner crystal, and not the short range part.
Yes and no.
Okay, we can.
The fact that nearest neighbor repel, and there is, if you have a finite density, there is only a way you can crystallize the particle. So that's essentially my question.
That's why a standard Wigner crystal would melt at high densities because one of R.
That's the term here. Wigner crystal has the density, has the interparticle distance above. And here's reverse, it's below.
So that's when you brought it.
And
so here you're saying that you can get something at high density, crystal phase at high density, whereas indeed for the Wigner crystal, the crystallization occurs at low density, the kinetic energy drops faster than the traction.
And the most important thing is if one looks at thermodynamic properties, this crystal will have, like a normal crystal, two sound modes. Mm-hmm. While a Wigner crystal in 2D will have one sound mode, transverse shear, but we'll have an incompressibility mode.
Yeah, but again, that's not the major problem. In a semiconducting structure, you have a gate that screens the interaction at the longer range, so then you get back.
That's true,
That's why I was saying the long range part of the interaction is not that crucial in some sense.
Okay, I would like to discuss this.
I guess the key point in all of this is that if you start actually compressing these things, at the point where you start maybe getting normally instability from some free body losses or something like that, this thing will form a crystal. And so it's actually at the point where normally collisions would hurt you, that this thing crystallizes and becomes sort of stabilized.
Yeah, but I think the point that indeed the crystallization is completely opposite. It occurs at large density rather than small density is a very important difference.
Yeah. And so we can map out the phase diagram. So the thermal melting of dipolar crystals in 2D has been studied by Kalida in 81 via molecular dynamics. So we can take this result over, so we can an estimate of the thermal melting temperature. At low interactions, we know it is a superfluid, so we can estimate the Kosterlitz-Fowlis temperature by the universal stiffness, and we know that the superfluid stiffness is a little bit below 1, so I made a sketch where this superfluid transition temperature is below the maximal possible temperature by Kosterlitz-Fowlis.
What's RT?
or the RS, the parameter, interactions divided by kinetic energy. And using quantum Monte Carlo, we now analyzed the transition at low temperatures. And what we find is nicely that the superfluid stiffness drops very sharply to zero at a value around 15 to 18. And also the structure factor drops zero, increases to a finite value at exactly the same point. So it's a strong indication that this is actually the first order phase transition from a superfluid to a crystalline phase, which is disappointing because there was maybe some hope that actually there could be a supersolid phase in between. But it seems here that it's a first order phase transition from crystalline to superfluid. And as I said before, RD for typical values can go up to 300, so one can go very deep into the crystalline phase. And if one looks at temperatures, then the blue line is essentially the quantum degeneracy temperature for bosons, which means that the crystalline phase should be accessible at higher temperatures than quantum degeneracy. So these phases are very stable and should be really easy to achieve them with polar molecules. And as Peter Solo said, the advantage of this crystal is that free body collisions are now completely quenched. So this is a way to really stabilize polar molecules. And it has, for example, many additional tools that this crystal now allows us to make lattices at arbitrary distances. So if we now look at two species, condensates, where we have polar molecules, and a second species in a layer trapped above, we can now really make lattices with triangular structure on different length scale, where the length scale can be tuned by the strength of the interaction.
Just for clarification, of course, when you say crystal, you mean Costelli style is like crystal, meaning Paolo decay of the positional order. This is 2D system.
Yes. Yes. Quasi long range order. Yes. But there is nothing. There is nothing like a Costellitz Fowler's melting, like proposed by Halperin and Nelson. So,
it's not via Halperin. Blah, blah, blah.
No. So it was discussed that here it's really a first order phase transition. No, that was found by Kalida.
But why can you now? I don't understand why you say there's no principle that says that allows. Normal crystal. Oh, that's what that is. Okay.
That's essentially it's a repulsive crystal, yes. And just yeah.
Kalida found that it's by Monte Carlo. Why aren't there? What's the physics that knows the
Costelli
melting for the 2D crystals?
Okay, that's
this. Very common. It's more common than classical.
Is there even an example where it is?
They're very
debatable.
Yeah. I think the nature of the crystal, isn't it? I mean, cannot it be really a long range order? Because it's a. Isn't it a discrete symmetry breaking? In the crystal, don't we need only to break a discrete symmetry?
No, we don't have a lattice here. The lattice is just it's just a 1D lattice trapping the system. There's no optical lattice within the 2D plane.
Okay.
So it's really translation invariant.
Can you compute the collision in
that? There are different quantum Monte Carlo simulations which. We estimated the coherence because the Wurm algorithm allows for calculating Green's function, and so the condensate fraction around these points were of order 10%, so it was very low. It should even decay, but
there's no superfluid. There's no condensated 2D, so it's really actually.
Yes, but okay, within the finite size, the Green's function saturated at some value which was 10% for this lattice side system. So It will for larger systems, but for our finite size system, it's still saturated. But it was very low compared to the superfluid stiffness, which is nearly one for these low temperatures we studied.
Can I ask a question, a little ignorant question? Are there any examples of first order transitions that are expected to be first order that have been actually probed in any way in a AMO optical system?
Even simpler example will be both Fermi mixtures. An even simpler example is both Fermi mixtures where we have phase separation, which is also first order.
So is there any...
Can you meet with an experiment?
There are many both Fermi mixtures. I wouldn't say Hillman is doing this experiment, but there are many where one sees the shell structure. Yeah. Okay, but now I would like, in my last part, I actually will come to the more interesting part, which is, so far we just have applied a static electric field, but now we can additionally tune the interactions using a microwave field. So let us focus on a sample where, so these are the four rotor states, so the n equals 0 state and n equals 1 state, which is split by a finite electric field. So the electric field induces a splitting of the mz equals 0 to the mz equals 1 and mz equals minus 1. And now we apply a microwave field coupling the ground state with the first excited state with m equals 1, which means we use a circular polarized light along the z direction. And for simplicity, I want to get rid of the degeneracy between these two states. So just forget these states at the moment. There is very simple ways to remove that state by using an additional microwave field. And it's very simple to keep it, but for simplicity of the discussion, I will neglect that actually these two states are degenerate and assume that this state is splitted from this state by an additional microwave field. And the microwave field is characterized by a detuning delta and a Rabi frequency omega.
These are excited rotational states?
These are two excited rotation states. And so we can essentially restrict the analysis only to these two excited states. So we have essentially again a spin system with the ground state and the excited states, and all other states can be ignored in the following analysis. So the Hamiltonian that uses to, again, if you go back to the kinetic energy, trapping potential, the internal structure, which is now a two-level system driven by the Rabi frequency with the tuning delta, which can be viewed as if we have a spin in an effective magnetic field, and we have the interactions due to the dipole-dipole interaction. Now, this interaction has two parts. The first part is actually that we have one atom is in one polar molecule in a ground state, the other one is excited, and they interchange a photon, which means that one polar molecule becomes excited and the other goes into the ground state. Which means that it's in spin language, a S plus SJ interaction, which has the structure of the dipole-dipole interactions with a strength determined by the matrix element, the dipole coupling between the ground and the excited state. And because we use a circular polarized light, it turns out that actually this interaction is attractive.
Light,
yes. And
one parameter change.
And mu of R, it has the typical anisotropic shape.
So in your experiment, in this discussion, then the circular polarized light is always on, is that right? So you have that microwave on to keep cycling them so that you can access these two states and we can use these. That's how you couple them, right?
It's just how we couple them, yes.
But I think it's very important to realize that the emission from the excited state in this case, if you would have zero temperature, is something like maybe, you see, 1,000 seconds. And
yes.
If you have minor temperature, like body radiation, then you would sort of maybe 1,000 seconds at room temperature. So the lifetime of these excited states, in the contrast to the electronic excitations, is extremely long-lived. And this makes it usable. So the same idea would not work in the case of an atom.
Exactly, yes. So
because it's microwave.
Yes. So the microwave has the spontaneous emission. Yeah, the dipole moment is still the same. It's just the density of states of the vacuum field.
Sorry, so this is the exchange of a microwave photon between the two particles.
Yes.
Separate particles, and this requires the dressing field. This is just something that occurs.
If you have a polymorphic in the ground state and one in the excited state, they will have this interaction always, yes. And in addition, there's the static part, which we have discussed before, because we have an applied static electric field. We have a dipole moment induced. And so the ground state has a dipole-dipole interaction, and also the excited state has a dipole-dipole interactions, which we can write that this is the effective dipole moment of one particle times the effective dipole moment of the other particle.
The coupling in the first line doesn't depend on the strength of the microwave.
So far, the strength of the microwave, these are just interactions, so there's no dependence on the strength of the microwave field. So the microwave field is in here, and these terms are just the dipole-dipole interaction, expressed and restricted to these two internal states, and making the rotating wave approximations that one doesn't consider higher states than that one focuses only on these two states, the ground and excited state.
And
so it's the ground state n equals 0 and n equal 1, mz equal 1. So it couples with a circular polarized microwave field. And I split these by the finite electric field. And the splitting is much larger than the tuning, such that I do not accidentally.
But I'm asking about E minus 1.
That one I removed. So in general, these two are degenerate and have to include it. Now I can remove the degeneracy. So ground state, this is the manifold here. Then I have the higher manifold, n equal 2. So if I apply a circular polarized microwave field coupling this state with this state, this will actually shift these two states. And I can remove the degeneracy from that with that. And this does not couple to this state because it's much higher the tuned.
Enough so that by large amount of the detuning you're considering in between one and ground state?
Again?
In other words, you introduce enough splitting that it's bigger than the
detuning
you're considering in reality.
And it's completely trivial to include this state, so I just neglect it for convenience. It doesn't change all the conclusions. Okay, so what we want to do now is to derive the effective interaction potential between the particles. For that, we apply the Born-Oppenheim approximations, which means we fix the interparticle distance, solve the Hamiltonian for the internal energies, which gives us the energy curves for fixed interparticle distance, and consider then these energies as the effective interaction potentials. So that means we fix the interparticle distance, diagonalize the Hamiltonian of the internal structure, take the eigenstates which adiabatically connects to our initial state, and the energies then describe the interaction potentials of our system. And to remind you that the ground state we choose, so we have the microwave field for each polar molecules, which gives us two states, which is a superposition of ground and excited state due to the coupling. So we take one of these states, prepare all polar molecules in this state, and are looking for the eigen, for the state here, which adiabatically connects to this ground state. And we want to do this at weak dipole interaction, which means we can essentially apply perturbation theory for calculating these eigenenergies. So, in first order perturbation theory for the eigenenergies, we just take the average of the dipole-dipole interactions to the ground state, and we obtain a nice dipole interactions between the polar molecules. However, the strength of the dipole interactions depends on two parameters, mainly the static induced dipole moments and an attractive part due to the microwave frequency coupling. And one sees that now, choosing the parameters, we can essentially tune lambda 1 to 0. So we can cancel the static dipole moment, induced dipole interactions, by adding a microwave field. Now this method is nothing new, but is essentially well known in NMR, where one is known as magic angle rotation or magic frequency rotation, that one has a spin dipole interaction between the spins, and if one applies an oscillating magnetic field, one can actually cancel the dipole interactions between the spins. And the same procedure we can do here. So this allows to tune the dipole-dipole interaction arbitrarily by setting the parameters of the microwave field and the static electric field. And so the interaction is then determined by the next corrections, which is second order. And so second order perturbation theory now provides us with the following terms. So we have the virtual excitation of a particle, which has the energy delta squared plus omega squared, and we have the second order term, which means the dipole interactions appear squared. But in addition, we don't know exactly where the excitation appears, so we get the correction, which also involves free body interactions. And again, the coupling matrix elements depend on the strength of the microwave field and the static electric field. And there's a very special point in the system where actually the dipole-dipole interaction vanishes, and for example also this term here, which means that free body interaction vanishes. And now one can use these energies and express it in effective interaction potentials. So we have a two-particle interaction potential, which the leading term is the dipole-dipole interaction. Then we have a correction from second order, where the dipole-dipole interaction appears squared. But in addition, there's also a free body interaction, which depends on the position of all these free particles. And as we can cancel the leading dipole-dipole, the free body interactions can become essentially the dominant interaction in our system. Now, all this analysis is valid as long as this scale here, which is the dipole coupling divided by the drive by the microwave field, this defines a distance R0 to the power 3. As long as this distance is much smaller than the interparticle distance, this analysis is valid. So in analogy to the previous part, we now have again used the induced interaction here, which should be repulsive, such that the particles never approach each other on shorter distances. And so now we have two tools to achieve this procedure. Either we can again transverse confine the system into 2D, then we have again a repulsive barrier from all directions with the saddle point again, which restricts that two particles get into the regime where R0 is of the order, where the interparticle distance is of the order of R0. Or alternatively, one sees that if the dipole-dipole interaction is cancelled, the remaining parts of the interactions is always repulsive, which means that even in free space, we get the purely repulsive interactions for polar molecules, which one can call that we have a perfect shielding of the polar molecules. So we restrict, we stabilize, we can stabilize the system also in 3D by by having this repulsive barrier and reducing free body recombinations.
Yeah, I have a question. Can you describe to the, again, what's the ratio between the free body and the two body coefficients?
I will come to that essentially the next slide. So it's, you see essentially that, so we have a lambda 0, so these lambda 0, lambda 2, and gamma 3 are essentially dimensionless parameters which are of the order of 0 to 1. So depending on the parameters, they vary between 0 and 1.
The R0 cube d is of the order of 1.
So this can be tuned by the tuning of your system. So you can change it between 10 is maybe 40 nanometers to 300 nanometers, depending what you choose for your detuning. So these parameters you can tune essentially, you just have to satisfy the condition that it is shorter than the interparticle distance. And you see that the...
I guess the reason my question is that suppose I was able to cancel the three-body interaction so that the three-body become a leading order now, then I would be pressed to ask, so what are the other corrections of it? So if I go to high order, the question, what series saturates, or whether every term is going to be of the same order, then I have to deal with a very difficult situation.
Your expansion parameter is exactly R0 divided by A.
I see.
So R0 divided by interparticle distance. So next order corrections are suppressed by this condition again.
You said even in 3D, you have this along this repulsive condition. So do you now need this confinement potential or not?
It depends. If I cancel the leading two-particle interaction,
then you don't need it.
Then I don't need it. Then I really have a 3D repulsive barrier, which will now allow also to create, if the interaction is strong enough, allows for making three-dimensional crystalline structures, which would be anisotropic because mu r squared is not isotropic anymore in five dimensions, but it's purely repulsive and stabilizes the system. This can be very important. Once one has polar molecules, it's completely unknown how stable is the system under collisions. Because in contrast to atoms, two atoms can collide and they are completely stable. However, polar molecules can actually undergo chemical reactions, so they can form a compound where I have three particles bound, and the other atom is excited at high energies. And as long as these parameters are not known, one doesn't know how one actually can evaporatively cool them. And such a shielding procedure would allow them that actually one can quench all these bad processes in the system and proceed with evaporative cooling. And so I come to my last part, which is now we have these interactions, now we can put the system into an optical lattice and look what type of Hubbard models can we derive. So I think I don't have to introduce what optical lattices are. So we have two laser lights, which a standing laser light, which produces a periodic structure for the system, which allows us to make 2D, 3D, and different setups, and allows us to design different lattice geometries. And the derivation of the effective Hubbard model now follows that we have the optical lattice and the kinetic energy and the effective interactions which we have derived previously. So the method is usually that this action dominates, so one solves the single particle problem in the presence of an optical lattice. This provides us with the Wannier functions of the problem. Then we can express the bosonic or fermionic field operator in terms of the Wannier functions and creation and annihilation operators into this Wannier function, and insert this ansatz into the Hamiltonian and express the interaction energy in terms of the Wannier function and the creation and annihilation operators. And this maps then the system to the Bose-Hubbard model, where we have the hopping energy J, which describes the rate with which one particle hops to the nearest neighbor side. Then we obtain a nearest neighbor onset interaction. We have nearest neighbor interactions between two polar molecules, and in addition, we also obtain now a free body interaction. Now important is, as we have excluded two polar molecules to be on top of each other, these are complete hardcore bosons if you start with bosons, and if you would start with the fermionic polar molecules. Also we have essentially, if we have different spin, the on-site interaction has gone to infinity by our approach, how we design the stability of the system. And the parameter strengths, if we take, for example, lithium-cesium, which has a dipole moment of 6 dBi, the Hopping energy for reasonably deep optical lattices is of the order of 0 to 0.5 recoil energies. And if you look at the lattice spacing, which is, okay, of lattice spacing of 500 nanometers, it induces a recoil energy of 1.4 kilohertz. And if we estimate the nearest neighbor interaction, U, due to the dipole-dipole interactions, it can be of the order of 30 recoil energies, which means it can become much, much larger than the Hopping energy. And even the free body interaction strength can be order of at the same scale, but is suppressed by this R0 divided by the typical lattice distance. However, I would say if one push the system, one can make this parameter 1/10 of the system and should still be valid. So it should be possible to have free body interactions of the order of recoil energies.
So AL is the lattice spacing.
Yes, lattice spacing.
What's R0?
R0 is this scale we have introduced before, which... Yes. It has, to give you a picture what it exactly is. So here you have an illustration what R0 is. So these are the curves. If you have two polar molecules in the ground state, they are not interacting. If one is in the ground state, one is excited, we have the dipole-dipole interaction. And if both are excited, they are again essentially non-interacting in absence of a microwave field. Now we induce the microwave field, which has couples the ground-ground state to this curve, and there is an avoided level crossing at the distance R0. And so R0 is essentially the point where this level crossing appears. And we want the particles to be far away from this level crossing. Okay, and to make, what can we now use this for? Let's make one example is if we drop free body interactions, we tune the parameters such that free body interaction is 0, then we can push the particle on a triangular lattice, which is known to have a supersolid phase transition. And so here's the phase diagram derived by Stefan Wessel and Matthias Kroyoff. And it's well known that at intermediate fillings, there's a supersolid phase appearing for Hopping energy divided by the nearest neighbor interactions of the order of 0.1. And using the previous numbers, one sees that we can either have a decay of the nearest neighbor interactions 1 over the distance to the cube. Well, in this regime, we can very easily introduce this ratio. So this ratio can be of the order of 300, even for reasonable Hopping energies of 0.1 recoil energies. But also for a faster decay, using the additional microwave field, we can reach this regime where the nearest neighbor interaction is so strong that we enter the supersolid phase. Alternatively, one can ask, what happens actually if you now have these free body interactions? And to my knowledge, very little is known about Hubbard models with free body interactions. So we started to study the 1D system, which is the simplest system. So we have nearest neighbor hop, we have Hopping energies between nearest neighbors well. Then we have free body interactions, which tells us that two particles close to each other are forbidden and cost us an energy W. We have set the on-site interaction of nearest neighbor to 0 by tuning the parameters properly, and then we are left with next nearest neighbor interactions, which are suppressed because the distance is farther apart. And so we have now, at the moment, we are doing quantum Monte Carlo simulations to analyze the phase diagram, but an idea what will happen can be achieved by using the bosonization techniques. So the system is very similar to the X-Y model with nearest neighbor as set interactions. And so using the same techniques with photonizations, one can get a sketch of the phase diagram, and one finds that there are three instabilities in a system for three different fillings, n equals 2/3, which is a trivial phase, because here we see really that we have two particles close to each other, then we have a hole, and then we have again two particles, and then a hole, and again two particles. So at n, filling n 2 over 3, we have a nice crystalline structure which should be stable if we increase the free-body interaction. However, there are additional phases appearing which are mainly characterized by a hopping correlation, which means that the boson hops most of the time to its neighboring site, but it hardly ever hops to the next nearest neighbor site. And so it's a crystalline phase which is characterized by a hopping correlation of this form. And alternatively, the ultimate quest would certainly be to look for string net configurations. And one asks, can we use these free body interactions now to actually define a low energy Hamiltonian which is characterized by a loop gas? And as my time is over, I will skip that and hope that somebody, that the one which are interested, will talk to me after my talk. And here are the conclusions. So we have polar molecules. We have stabilized the system. We can stabilize the system. We can make crystalline structures which are very stable, which allows us to make different lattice structures and allows us to study now atoms with phonons interactions. And I have shown you that we can induce free body interactions to have, if we apply an optical lattice, and we have tunable free body interactions in the system. Thank you for your attention.
Question.
You made the Born Oppenheimer approximation. Is that because you were anticipating that you were going to put it on an optical lattice? Or is that for another reason? No, that is in principle always valid, as long as my kinetic energy is much lower than the level slipping of the different Born Oppenheimer curves. So, I mean, even thus, yeah. So in this sample, it is well justified. The Born-Oppenheimer exactly breaks down well once we have these avoided level crossings. And the aim is to stay out of the way from these avoided level crossings. And so the interaction, the level splitting between the different curves is much, much higher than the kinetic energy.
When you're talking about the extended Hubble models, you introduce that with by talking about this microwave field and using interaction using that.
Yes.
If you just apply an electric field and then use the and then strong trapping potential in the third direction, that doesn't allow you to simulate the extended Hubble model, right?
Not quite. So.
Ignoring the three
buttons. Yeah, let's just look at the interaction. Yeah, so this sum we obtained without microwave field. Mm-hmm. So it's in that sense an extended Hubble model is decaying with 1 to the R cube, you get just applying a static electric field. Yes. If you want to tune it further by reducing next nearest neighbor, then one can tune it via this additional microwave field. But if you are just interested in hardcore bosons, even nearest neighbor interactions, which decays with 1 to the RQ, you don't need a microwave field to apply.
Okay,
no more questions? Yes, so thank you.